Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the VFX Show, coming to you from the new fxguide.com. If you haven't checked it out, you should go and have a look. And we're looking at the Green Hornet, Michelle Gondry. And I've got to tell you, Michelle Gondry is the reason I wanted to do this show before I even saw the film. Joined, as we are this week, by the two Jasons. Jason Diamond, sir, how are you?
Howdy. Howdy do.
Now, you've generously stayed up until the wee hours to do this with us, avoiding me getting up at 1 a.m. or at 5 a.m., so thank you for that, sir.
Oh, not a problem. I'm up anyway.
And Jason Wingrove, how are you, sir?
How are we? Very happy when it's not at 5 a.m.
Yes. Now, if you hear any sort of what sounds like white noise in the back from Jason, he's actually out near lovely Australian bush, and it's summer here, and the what you might think of as crickets, we call them something else, cicadas, are making a noise. And that's, to me, music to my ears, but I give you a preemptive warning in case the audio engineers can't get that out. So, guys, let's start with the Green Hornet. We're going to discuss this. I'd like to discuss it in terms of Michelle Gondry as much as the Green Hornet when we come to sort of our secondary part, because I find him a fascinating director. Mm. So having both of you on is really terrific. And a fascinating director because he has deployed some really interesting uses of visual effects that are perhaps not as photorealistic deliberately as some other directors may go. So let's start with our quick rundown on the film, what we think of it. And right out of the gate, Jason Diamond, I'm going to refer to you as Jason. I'm going to refer to you, Jason Wingrove, as Jace. So, Jason, what did you think? Did you like the film?
Yes, I was pleasantly surprised, not because I didn't expect great things from Gondry, but just I had heard a lot of mutterings and things from people who had seen the film in early versions and whatnot, and they were less than blown away, but honestly, I really liked it. It was fun. I mean, I think you have to be a fan of Seth Rogen.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much,
you know, runs the film in terms of style. And I don't really have a huge problem with him. I thought Jay Chou was amazing and will probably be the next Bruce Lee because he, who played Kato, cause he was phenomenal. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I thought it had a great mix of action and humor, and had the Gondry touch in a lot of spots where it should, and other spots where it probably was impossible to be Gondryized, and it was just, you know, standard movie making.
Jason, I'd like your opinion, and also, if I can, get your opinion on whether or not you think this could have been made as a more serious film, because a lot of people obviously have gone that way with films of superheroes and heroes. They've done things that are much more realistic. I mean, obviously, A Dark Knight is the classic example. It's not in any way tongue-in-cheek. This is a bit tongue-in-cheek. Do you think it worked, and could it have been done any other way?
I think it totally worked. I don't know enough of the original Green Hornet to know from a purist point of view if it was true to the vibe or not. But it maybe was a little tongue-in-cheek for me, but again, I think that's really just the way Seth Rogen played it. I don't think that was a direction thing. And since Seth Rogen and his buddy wrote it, it sort of had that Superbad vibe to it, which is fine. I don't think it could have been a super serious film. I think it worked fine. Maybe it could have been a touch more serious, but I don't really think it would have been that big a deal.
And Jace, with your director experience, what do you think? The same question.
Well, I pretty much go with you, Jason. I wasn't quite sure what to expect going into it. I'm a huge fan of Gondry since his very, very first early clips. Never seen anything to do with the radio plays or any graphic novels or anything to do with Green Hornet, whatever it is. So really went into it totally cold, not knowing what to expect. And I really actually came out of it really quite liking it. I mean, as you say, I think you have to be a bit of a fan of Seth Rogen, because as you say, it's more of a Seth Rogen film with some sort of graphic novel sort of overtones or sort of superhero overtones versus a superhero film with Seth Rogen in it. So, and I think that was actually quite good. It sort of added a bit of a change of pace for me to the usual kind of fare that we're used to of these, you know, sort of rehashes of or revisionings of graphic novels. So, look, I was really, really pleasantly surprised with it. There was enough sort of Gondry in there for me that I was hoping for, and it was really funny. As you say, the guy who plays Kato is sensational. It was utterly brilliant, and yes, it won't be the last thing we see of him. Looked great, yeah. And I thought it was, you know, a really good package, and I think it was one of those ones where going into it, I wasn't quite sure whether to take, you know, you're not quite sure whether to take the wife or not, or whether you go to, but now I think I have to, you know, go and have another trip and go see it with her, because I think it's definitely worth another look and something beyond just the regular kind of boy film fodder.
Hey, can I ask you, Jace, there was a release of videos, I'm going back now, God, to the beginning of like 2003 kind of time frame. There were videos of people like Michelle Gondry, Chris Cunningham. They were director videos. I think everybody got them. I know I did. I assume you would have seen them. You wanted some?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't own any of them, but I sort of lust over them at the video shop every time I see them. I sort of a directing, like a profile on a particular director, one DVD on their sort of style. Or, yeah, I can't name the series.
There was Spike Jonze. There was Chris Cunningham. And yep. I know there was Michelle Gondry. And I think since then, Michelle Gondry's released additional ones.
Yeah.
But I think the thing is, they highlighted a lot of music videos that Michelle Gondry had done. And I'm just wondering, when you say you're a fan of Michelle Gondry, were you sort of, you know, the Come Into My World, Kylie Minogue kind of video stuff that was really Chemical Brothers stuff, or was it really Sunshine of the...
Even early, his first kind of film clips, there's a fantastic one. It's all over YouTube. I'm sure you can Google it, called Lucas with the Lid Off. And it is one shot done on film, very cheaply, all in camera, in Steadicam. And it is just a masterpiece once you know how it's done. And it's all literally looking through mirrors. And then you move over to... it's very much like that. I'm trying to think. There's a Massive Attack clip he did where it's sort of...
Protection?
I think so, where he's sort of basically craning all through like
apartment block.
Kind of apartment block. Yeah. It's kind of like that, except... in a very small cramped place, and you're looking into mirrors, and then people are upside down, and it's literally and the fact that it's all done in camera and all in one shot, and I just kind of, it's riveting. And that was literally my first exposure to him on a shots reel, probably back in 1984 or something. And then yes, of course, Come Into My World, but the multiple Kylies on the street corner in Paris is just outstanding. So I just love his rubber band and paperclip technology approach to something, and let's work out a really cool thing to do, and then let's work out how we do it. Be Kind Rewind has got much of that in it too. I mean, it's a very interesting style. Not many people. It's not as well liked as say Eternal Sunshine, but it's, you know, definitely. I love the fact that he thinks outside the square and gets away with it.
Jason, you both direct music videos. You're obviously in a band as well, as we've discussed in the past. You are probably considerably younger than me, but anyway. Were you into that kind of Michelle Gondry stuff, the White Stripes, those Chemical Brothers videos that he did?
Yeah. I remember seeing him back from all his videos, and so much so that when Human Behavior, the movie, his first film with Reese Ifans and Patricia Arquette and Tim Robbins came out, I like flew to the theater to see it with my wife, and I loved it. He utilized a lot of the things that he had tried and experimented with in the music videos, you know, with his rear projection stuff that he did with Bjork on the Human Behavior music video, ironically. And I think he's really inventive and thinks of interesting ways to attack a problem or a creative idea.
Yeah, I remember seeing a YouTube video that he did solving a Rubik's Cube with his toes. And I just remember thinking, there's no end to how open this guy is and inventive.
Sensational.
He really puts himself out there. Okay, so we've established that we like his style, and some of that's coming in. I think that it's certainly one of the really interesting aspects of this film when we get to the visual effects is these sequences where he does some of that. But before we do... the sort of specifics on that. Let's give a bit of a rundown on the parameters of the show. So it was dimensionalized post the effect. So I saw it in stereo. Did you guys, Jason Diamond, did you see it in stereo?
I saw stereo IMAX, actually.
Okay. Wow.
Right. We just saw regular stereo.
Stereo. And was that proper IMAX? Like it was really huge field of view stuff?
I think it's the what they call mini IMAX. You know, right. It's... it wasn't the massive.
What's it called, IMAX?
Is it? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what they jokingly called then.
Yeah. it's just basically a larger screen. But
okay.
But it was it looked great.
So 650 shots. And if you want to read up about this, Ian at FX Guide's written a really great story about gondrifying the Green Hornet. Actually, I got to ask you guys, what is it with this green thing? Like, there's Green Hornet, there's Green Lantern, there's green... What was the guy in Spider-Man? There was just green.
Green Goblin. Mm-hmm.
Green Goblin. Mm-hmm. I think they... pre this film coming out, I wouldn't have been able to tell you the difference between Green Lantern and Green Hornet. But that's just
not exactly nature's warning color or anything, is it? I don't know. I'm not sure.
But anyway, the thing about it is when I found out about it and looked it up and obviously understood the background of it being a radio play and stuff, I think that it was a great way to go, because I think if you'd tried to make it too serious, it would have just been odd in this day and age to have a, you know, sidekick, be them Korean, Japanese, or whatever nationality he now is, because obviously they changed the nationality when America went to war in the original.
Right.
I think, though, that for all of that, it was Michel Gondry that got me in. And Michel Gondry has this trademark, I think you touched on it, Jace, that he tends to do stuff in camera. And yet a lot of this stuff wasn't in camera. Although 650 shots, and I'm leaving out the dimensionalization for a second, you know, stuff when they're driving around in that 65 Lincoln Continental, that's blue screen.
Maybe he's run out of ways to do stuff in camera. But look, I think this is far bigger a palette and far bigger production than his previous films. Everyone would probably agree. This is a full on, in some areas, goes into a massive blockbuster kind of area, far beyond, you know, his normal fare. So I think. And obviously there's large second unit contingent by Vic Armstrong. Massive, a lot of practical effects and stunt effects. It's a very much bigger palette. So I'm sure there's probably a lot of in-camera stuff going on in some of the... you talk about like going around in the... they first discover, you know, go through the garage of supercars. There's all that sort of, you know, slow-mo, sort of time-lapse
the
pans.
The kissing when...
going from car to car.
Car to car, yep.
Yeah, I mean, sort of stuff like that, sort of a bit sort of simple and slapstick, not quite to the level of, you know, all the stuff like springs, radiator springs and fans and things in front of the camera on Be Kind Rewind to create like a Super 8 effect. Yeah, there's not so much of that, but there's plenty of other more visual effects-based stuff that is still very much his trademark, you know. Well, there's not a lot of in-camera stuff going on with the Kylie Minogue clip either, I guess.
Well, what I think is good is that he was able to maybe get out of his own way a little bit and not have to put his thumbprint on every frame and be like, well, this is just, I need a shot of all the cars in the garage. Let's make a nice shot of all the cars in the garage. Not how can we make this shot wacky?
But yeah. Didn't he do exactly that by speeding it up and having them kiss in?
Yeah, but that's not over the top. It's not over the top.
No, like, but it's a Gondry look. I would have given that as an exact example of doing a straight pan, he made it sort of slapsticky. Though,
at the end of the day, it's still a narrative film and we still have to let all that sort of breathe.
Right, that's what I mean.
I guess it's striking a bit of a balance. I think what we could probably all agree that what he does is, and what is overall the entire film as a package, that it has character. This is not rubber stamped something. This is not come out of the sausage machine. This has been crafted script wise and visually, and it's all come together in a really characterful package. It's got enough of the Gondry bits in there to sort of, you know, flesh it all out. And so I guess it's quite a balanced film, I suppose, in that way.
I think that you're right, Jason, that it has a narrative arc that isn't typical Gondry, but obviously when he does a flashback like they do in the sushi restaurant, it's just full on Gondry film clip on, you know, like you'd have been on set going, what the heck are we filming today?
Yeah.
So I do agree with you. I think the only reason that it doesn't feel like it's extreme Gondry is that if you haven't seen extreme Gondry, you assume that this is extreme, and of course this isn't. He's in a safety zone compared to what he's done, but in a good way. I think the other thing we should do is acknowledge some of the other people that someone like a Gondry can attract, because one of the great advantages of being, I think, a really great, brave filmmaker is you can pull some really great people in around you. And I'm going to talk now not about actors who maybe the popular press would go for, but some of those people like, well, for example, the production designer. Did either of you notice who the production designer was on this? It was Owen Paterson. You'd know Owen, right? Jace?
Yeah, absolutely. I've worked with him plenty of times on commercials here in Sydney. He's Australian who got his, I guess, his main huge break on The Matrix, and then there's no stopping him. Now, we haven't seen him in the in Australia for years and years.
But, so, I mean, his kind of production design on The Matrix, I mean, whatever you think of Revolutions and Reloaded, and I don't want to go there, they were the coolest films of the early, you know, 2000s. I mean, certainly his production design helped those films an enormous amount, and I honestly think that his production design looks sensational in this one as well. I was really glad to see him doing some nice work like this.
Yeah, no, I'm just rapt that he's kicking it. It's really great. Lovely guy. Couldn't happen to a better guy.
And also the cinematographer was God, I'm scratching
John, Schwartzman.
Yeah,
John Schwartzman, who's done a ton of stuff. I think he might have done The Rock, and I'm speaking out my bum at the moment. Yeah,
well, he's done some really big stuff, because he did Pearl Harbor, because I know he's just doing a lot of stuff on Pearl Harbor to do with an ILM piece for FX Guide, and I'm sure he was the DOP on Pearl Harbor. Yeah,
he's a long time Michael Bay collaborator.
Yeah, so he can produce very well, basically well lit, slick, kind of good looking shots, and in a film like this, you need a bunch of those, I guess, because, you know, while it was on the edge of realism, it wasn't like, say, Speed Racer. It wasn't a stylized film.
It wasn't Dick Tracy or anything.
No, exactly. Hey, so on the green screen stuff, on blue screen stuff, were there any shots that you thought, oh, that's obviously blue green screen, not because you logically knew that it would be, but because it looked that way?
Nope. I thought a couple of the close-ups of the flower when the bee stung him was a little roto-y. It was hit and miss, but very, very minor. I mean, my ultimate test is the car stuff, and that was seamless. I mean, that was dead nuts comped.
Yeah, although, it didn't take you out of the movie anyway, did it?
Not at all.
I think that the car stuff, you're absolutely right, totally acceptably great stuff, and we're very harsh on car shots on this show. I didn't feel that, I'm afraid, about them sitting in the chair after the parachute went. That was, I thought, not at the same standard that the car work was at.
It was a little Wonka Vader.
It is a really hard thing to get the motion of somebody hanging on wires to match the motion of the backplate helicopter footage. Neither of them can be motion control, sort of almost by definition. They're swinging in one and from a chopper in the other. But I just thought if maybe the film didn't call for this, but I would have definitely gone with a virtual background, so they got a much better match between the foreground and the background for that movement.
Yeah. You could, for that rig, you could shoot that with a spider cam, which is kind of like a small kind of studio-based, like a sky cam, basically on a camera on wires, which can be pre-programmed and then can obviously spit out data for you for 3D. But obviously it also comes down to, you know, how much money was left at that point in the game, because it's there's a lot going on and there's a, you know, it's a lot happening. I'm not sure what the actual budget was, but I'm pretty sure they, you know, got every dollar on screen.
I think a lot of the car effects, in addition to the green screen, blue screen work on the car, were also good. I think that was Hammerhead. Like, for example, when the cops were kind of chasing them early on and they started invoking some of the gadgets in the car. I mean, obviously, it was fairly comical by the end what had happened with the car. I mean, the fact that the car was still going made it a remarkable vehicle. But that's fine. Like, I mean, it's in the context of the film. But I guess what I'm saying is that the 3D elements with the car that were added onto the car, because obviously it didn't have, you know, things coming out of the hubcaps that were slicing and dicing police cars. I thought that was all really good as well. It was hard tracks, well composited.
If you told me it was practical, apart from the guns, because it's sort of impossible sort of space for them to almost come out of, but like the stuff coming out of the wheels, if you told me it was practical, I would have totally bought it. I thought all of that stuff was completely photoreal. None of that sort of, you know, stuff like the mask or anything sort of crazy or cartoony. It was completely photoreal. Lighting on everything, completely the reflections and everything all felt really good. And there's a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. And Jason, what did you think of that print? So the car in the printer or print factory environment, though.
That
was also green screen.
I only really had a problem with when Kato was able to get the car off of the printer and then driving down when it fell.
Was that a conceptual problem or a physics problem?
It was a physics problem, not a compositing issue. Just the way it hit the ground. Well, I mean, you know, you're already way past conceptual at that point, so I went with it.
But it was singularly less successful. It was singularly less successful, I think, than the car and the elevator, which actually a lot of that was practical. Obviously, the guy being squashed wasn't.
That was quite amazing. Really good.
I like that.
Oh, that was amazing. That was amazing. That was huge. That was huge.
And getting broken by the roof thing, I thought was really, really good.
Was that? I mean, was that just like sort of dummy, and then replace a real guy and swap over to a dummy at the last frame? Or I'm not quite sure how they did that. But obviously, the cars, most of it looked all practical, and that was
They actually drove a car into a lift area, and that lift area then shot up. Now, obviously, it wasn't a lift in a front of a lobby like. It wasn't like a real thing, but it was a real thing in the sense that it went up in the air several stories and clipped a car, which dropped down. Obviously, there just was no actor standing below to get
it was to get whacked. Completely amazing.
I liked all the sort of like Roadrunner style guys getting squashed gags that they did, like that one, and when the guys got rolled over by the cement back of the cement truck when it broke off. Because it's not like gory or over the top. It's just like cartoony, which I thought was
not a drop of blood really in the whole film, essentially, or not large drops of sort of massive.
No, this splattering.
Is 300. This was quite pulled back in that, obviously, to keep the audience fairly a bit as broad as possible.
Okay, so if we stop at that point, if we were to stop the film, then you'd have two things, I think, that would mean that this film didn't show Gondry off. The two being the dream, well, not the dream sequence, the flashback sequence, which was, and we kind of hinted at already, fairly out there, but obviously heavily composited. And the other one, which we now need to talk about, I think, is the bending time stuff. And I think that's interesting at many, many levels. The telescopic effect and the Kato vision and the way that things kind of expanded out. So we had sort of multiple cars that he jumped over. So let's walk our way through those. And let's start, I guess, with the Kato vision, which is this idea of him identifying where weapons are and doing stuff. Jace, what did you think of that?
I thought it was really impressive. It was only afterwards that I really worked out, hang on a second, this is really a lot trickier than it looks, when you sort of essentially got slow-mo and normal speed or slightly slow-mo mixed in with incredibly slow-mo in the same shot with camera moves, not breaking away a little bit from the Kato vision. I still not quite sure how they did that, but it was seamless and incredibly impressive. And almost afterwards you sort of think, wow, that was really, it almost sort of takes you by surprise a bit. There's a lot going on, and what it does do is it feels very fresh and very interesting, and it's not the standard kind of bullet time.
I must admit, this was done by CIS Hollywood, and they did 130 shots on Hornet, which included the fight sequences, the retiming and comping work. I was so glad when I heard it was those guys, because I have a real soft spot for those guys. Jeff used to work at CIS. I used to go to LA in the early days and hang out in the back of Jeff's suite till he was finished the session so we could go and do something. I think it's a great facility. I'm so glad to see them delivering on something so creative and so strong. I thought it was great, that. So what about you, Jason?
I loved it. I was waiting. That was sort of one of the larger Gondry-esque moments. I felt where he really stepped out, or they let his style step out, was in the telescoping effect of the cars and the sort of chopped up time aspect. The Kato vision was awesome, but it was just a little more. It actually felt like the Sherlock Holmes segment where Holmes runs through the what he's going to do and then he does it, which is cool because I like it. It sets up the character's abilities. I liked that because it was dimensionalized, they took the opportunity to chop it up, roto everything, and then recreate a space that they could move around in that the camera never actually did. But it felt like the camera did. It felt very organic. It wasn't overly robotic.
So that is really a post-house coming to the front there. This is a director who say, I want to do this in the shot, then just doing a ton of multiple passes and then literally creating that whole, from what I understand, stop me, Mike, if I'm wrong, is literally that is just just grunting through being able to cut people out of backgrounds and replacing backgrounds and rotoing people and literally with brute force creating those shots out of just bare plates. There's no sort of clever
It was shot on Phantom, so it was overcranked.
Yeah.
I think they were going at about 17. And there's an article that Ian's written, which is on FX Insider. For those of you who don't know, Insider is a new thing on FX Guide for people that have sort of basically, I don't know, it's our way of saying thanks for people that help out with FX Guide. And so you can sign up and become a member of that. But it is after you've donated to the site. But anyway, so for those of you that have seen that story, the second story, in other words, the Insider story, he goes through that telescoping effect and stuff. So going on the basis of that, yes, it was done on the Phantom. They basically don't have super high-res files out of the Phantom, but I don't think you really notice the difference. But then a lot of that was just fed into Flame. And CIS has been a Flame house for years. And obviously Jeff was Jeff worked on Contact at CIS when he was there on Flame. But they're very good at Flame. And so they used Flame with the image plugins from the Foundry, which are the Furnace plugins. You hear a lot about their Stereo plugins, which are completely different. These are their traditional image processing plugins, which at their heart have Kronos for retiming, so that can retime footage. Now, to say that, it was shot over crank, so they already had a lot of frames. So there was retiming going on, but it wasn't like it was going off the original 24 frames a second. And then they were also doing a bunch of stuff in that with aligning passes, because there's a plugin as part of the Foundry set and part of the Furnace plugin set that will take two passes and then align them and sort of match them up. So it's not poor man's motion control. It's like if you do two passes, it will spatially and temporally line them up for you. And that's been in there for a while now, and they've just used it very, very effectively, that and some of the other tools for deforming and tracking and stuff. But you're right, like it's a lot of hard work to get those shots to happen. Having said that, I'm willing to bet, I bet you'd agree with me on this one, Jason, that we're going to see this elsewhere, because people are just going to adopt this and use it for a bunch of other different things now they've seen this.
It's going to make its way into a lot of commercials, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's just no
but
way.
But it's hard work. That's going to stop a lot of people. This isn't just like, oh, if we slow down this and speed up that, we get this. You know, this is, there is no quick fix to this. And this is, yes, you probably will see it, but this is not going to be for everybody's budgets.
No, and to do the multiple car stuff where Kato, you know, so it basically jumps over the car and it sends out to, I think, about what? Is it half a dozen cars?
I think it's like, five or six.
So they're having to basically recreate cars and then patch them in and build that out and to get that telescoping effect. I can't remember. I'm sorry. I couldn't go through all these videos. But there was a video he did that in with real people. Like you'd cut to a shot in a music video and then the camera would move off axis and you'd see there were like eight people in a line.
There was some of that in the Chemical Brothers video, but he also did that in a real stop motion sense with the White Stripes video. In Brooklyn, right. I think it was.
So it felt like a signature Gondry thing. And you know what? I was really glad that he did it, because there's a reason you call it a signature thing. I mean, if you invented it, you know, use it. I mean, it's a good look. It's his thing, and
it wasn't like a crutch. I mean,
it was adding to the energy of the whole.
Yeah, absolutely,
fight,
completely
giving it a uniqueness.
Yeah, completely.
And somebody else might have done that with a zoom in while tracking back kind of, you know, compression thing, like I saw in Vertigo. It had that kind of a feel to me, but in an original way. So I thought it was completely valid.
Yeah.
Yep. No, it's sensational. Can I jump to another signature one? I thought of him, or reminded me of some of his other work, was the really interesting, and all the more interesting in 3D, was the split screen, let's all head out and go and kill the Green Hornet, and everyone sort of heads out to kill anybody wearing green. And the split screen shots were just sensational, not just for their coordination camera-wise, but also for what they ended up doing with them in 3D.
Okay, now that's really interesting, because I thought that failed in 3D. I thought it worked great as a device, and it was funny, the idea of spreading it around, you know, that it would spread like gossip does. But in 3D, I actually took my glasses off at that point, because I felt like we had different stereoscopic resolutions all over the screen, and I was sort of, it bugged me. What about you, Jason? Because if Jace liked it, did you?
I had a problem with the black lines. they weren't consistent.
Yeah,
they would start out at one width and then they would slowly be opening and closing. Like, but I don't think in a creative way. Just I think it was just they're patching all the shots in there and all the numbers weren't lined up or whatever. But also, it seemed like, and maybe it was just me, it seemed like they were trying to add a little bit of depth to the boxes on some of them, or maybe just the lines weren't, the convergence was off on some of the lines or something. It just, it looked a little weird in the lines.
I felt wrong as well, yeah.
Escape me, maybe I was in my sort of, I was drinking the Gondry Kool-Aid at that point and didn't sort of,
I like,
it didn't flag to me. I just, it sort of stuck out to me and it didn't set off any kind of gimmick alarms too much. But I must say I didn't notice anything of the bad lineups.
Felt to me like the end of The Godfather when they go out and shoot Mo Green and like they go and shoot everybody. Sort of felt like that a little bit.
I thought it was great. I just thought that would have worked really well at every level in mono. In stereo, you needed to really control it because it was so much going on. It was just like too busy stereoscopically.
Yeah. I would have loved it in more Gondry, full Gondry style, if somehow everyone had gone their separate ways and then linked up again. I can't remember the name of the clip. Yeah. You might remember, Jason, but there's an excellent Japanese film clip that Gondry did of two Japanese girls, and they start off in their apartments, and they meet with a car crash in the middle. And this is all totally split screen, left, right.
It's actually one's forward, one's backwards.
And I remember watching that for hours.
And then they meet and they car crash, and then the other one that was forwards ended up going backwards, and they both end up back in each other's beds, and it's completely nuts, but completely reminded me. I was hoping that they would sort of, it would go kind of full circle, but I still didn't mind it.
I was intrigued by that. But did that film clip do what you just described? I think it felt like it did that. But wasn't it just that one side was forward and one side was backwards?
Yeah.
Or did it stop and cut in the middle?
No, it doesn't cut, I don't think.
There's no cut, no.
It's Chiba Motto.
The girls change over, I think. There's the left side always stays reversed or whatever, and the right side always is...
Yeah. I think it's Chiba Motto or at least Yuka Honda, one of them.
It was a cracker of a clip, but I just remember when it came out, it was on the shots reel, and I just sat there staring at it, looking for where the effects were, and I seem to remember there just were hardly any effects, if any.
Anyway, I remember it better than it probably was, but which is always good.
So what I liked about this whole fight scene, or all of them, but at least it seems like they didn't go out of their way to invent new tricks. It was a lot of, and I use the word standard not as a quality judgment, but just like standard hardcore visual effects techniques pulled together into like a new recipe. It wasn't like we got to go out and figure out bullet time or something like that. It was solid work.
Yeah, it was
to get it done.
You're so right. It was, you wouldn't give these guys a technical Oscar for pushing the technical boundaries of the craft. You might give them a creative award for doing it really well.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's discuss the stereo stuff for a second, because we already touched on it with... Oh, no, wait, we got to give it that one, the sequence. The flashback with the him piecing together what had happened with his father and stuff. So... Jace, do you think it worked creatively? It was pretty wacky.
It was pretty wacky. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, I went into it knowing that it had been post-dimensionalized. So I was wondering whether it was added in as a what can we do now we're going 3D thing, or whether that was entirely planned. Obviously, it was a fantastic, post-design exercise. It was just beautifully pulled off, and obviously with a lot of elements shot specifically, but also taking from a lot of elements just within the film and just, taking them and playing with them and So I thought it was really quite fun because it's obviously it all sort of ties back into a bit of a joke at the end, like, you know, that he's taken this long to work it out. It's kind of like the sort of humorous version, as you say, of the Sherlock Holmes working it out, except this sort of
as a flip on the Kato vision. Like Kato could scan a scene in milliseconds and work out where everything was and what he had to do. And
yes, but it did still come back to being true. It still did come back to being self-deprecating towards Green Hornet. That it was just so. Hello, I'm still here. You've been spy 5 minutes with a stupid look on your face. Are you with me? So
saying, I'm assuming you're working out how this all works because you had this stupid look. And I thought that was awesome. Great joke.
I laughed out loud several times when watching this.
Absolutely. I think that I think that scene, the sort of piecing it all together scene, reminded me stylistically of I think it was one of the first sort of dreamy sequences that Jim Carrey has in Eternal Sunshine, when he's walking through, and they repeat it a bunch in the movie, but when he's walking through the office and Tom Wilkinson, who's in that movie also, the whole thing's shot with the Gondry spotlight vibe. And they keep doing those passes of things changing and multiple people backing up on each other. It's not editorially the same, but it had the same vibe to me.
I mean, I loved in Sunshine when they got into the VW bug and the car kind of erased as they went through it. Do you know the shot I'm talking about?
Yeah.
And there was things like that, and cars just falling out of the sky in the back of shots. And there were just things in it where you were looking at it and you were saying, that's disturbing. But in every respect, you didn't feel like it was gratuitous. And I got to say, for a kind of big blockbuster film, which obviously had 650 effects, I didn't get one of those sequences where I was just kind of yawning because I knew it was an action piece, that they were just going to doing for the hell of it and there was no point in it. A couple of people said they thought the ending went on too long, but I thought it was okay. I thought that he used effects appropriately.
It's went to some of that sort of whimsy and some of that lighthearted stuff that I wished maybe that Inception had gone to. But anyway, that's another entire podcast. Shall I just quickly jump back?
You can't criticize Inception.
The Japanese split screen clip is called Sibo. Is Sibo Mato?
Yeah, Chibo Mato.
Sugar Water. Sugar Water is the name of the clip. CIBOMATO for those googling along at home.
Yeah, and honestly, if you are not as familiar with Michel Gondry's film clip stuff, it's a film school in a DVD if you want to get his stuff. In fact, actually, all of those ones we mentioned, the Chris Cunningham one is similarly, they're all on Amazon. I think you can buy all of them for like $60. It's I remember when they came out, and obviously this is going back a few years, but nevertheless, they were really just, we're not worthy kind of, and of course, Spike Jones. Some of these directors haven't made the best features, but I think Gondry has done a really good job in bridging the line. I don't think he's kind of...
I like all his features.
Yeah.
It's the Work of Director series, apparently. Yep, there's Spike Jones, Mark Romanek, Gondry, Jonathan Glazer.
You know what? What I always find interesting is you always have these... It's in music and film, and it's really in anything. You have people who have the inception, not to use that word, of an idea, and do it, and are successful, do it exactly the way they want it, and then you have the people who do, not in a rip-off, but are influenced by them and do it slightly more commercially. And in this case, I think you would say that Gondry started a style and sticks with his thing, and Spike Jones is the... more commercial version of Gondry, in that he takes very similar ideas. They both worked with Charlie Kaufman to have that sort of, at least initially, to have that off-kilter, really wacky but super deep scripts. And I'm not saying that as a slight to Spike Jones, because I think he's incredibly talented. But I think that he sort of takes it and runs with it in a different way. But I think he's influenced by Gondry in a very big way.
So I'm just jumping back quickly to what we were talking about before, which was the flashback 5 minute working it out in the restaurant design montage. I'm not sure if we'd finish with that, but I guess my main thing was just hands off, hats off. Just was it was beautifully, sensationally done. It was a gorgeous piece of design, and had a bit of a smile to it, and you sort of again added to the whole character of the film.
I think the reason that I wanted to discuss the directors is because I do applaud directors that are able to do something like that sequence, which is using visual effects neither gratuitously or just in photorealistic sense. It's not like they're getting themselves out of a problem, and they're also not just saying, oh, it'd be awesome if they jumped on the side of the rocket and rode it up into space and then used the door to kind of surf back down, and you kind of yawning going, oh my God, that's such a waste of computer time and resources. And I think there are directors that are sort of have come around almost to computer graphics, like you see them doing more of it, or computer visual effects, they're doing more of it, and you kind of go, well, okay, well, obviously earlier in their career maybe they were a bit suspicious of it, but now they're obviously using it really, really well. And then there are those that of this bunch that came through, because you were talking before about some of those other directors. I think you mentioned Glazier, that's the English director, right? He did So, see, directors like that, I'm sure he...
I'm not quite sure.
But he did a lot of music videos with bands that allowed and supported that. Because if you think of, like, White Stripes you mentioned earlier, but Massive Attack, Radiohead, those kind of artists, because there have been some amazing film clips by these people, partly because they had amazing collaboration with the artists that have allowed them to do that kind of stuff. I don't think it's an accident that those bands and those directors tend to be a kind of group that work together.
I mean, it's very creative bands that they've hooked up with, and, you know, like Björk and all that sort of stuff for Gondry. These are artists that are out there and that have let themselves be taken that way. There's a lot of artists, I'm sure, as you would probably attest, Jason, who don't want to do anything crazy or don't want to break the mold and just happy to just I just want to do like what this guy did, let's do that.
Absolutely. Please. I was not to go off topic too much, but I had a meeting not too long ago when I was in LA about some music videos, and they were telling me about a band that had been pitched a really awesome idea, and they're like, no, but we just want to take this part out of it and just do this, and they're like, but that's going to be really boring. You know that. They're like, yeah, but we want to do that. And the person who's telling me the story said the initial concept was really great. Not, you know, over the top, insane visual effects, whatever, but just had a nice feel to it. And the band was like, no, get rid of that. I don't like that. And the video sucks.
Well, I think what's really good is if you can do this and you, because I obviously respect anyone that can do really great seamless visual effects where we come out of it and we're just discussing it here on the show, and it's really hard to even identify the visual effects, so they're just so well integrated into the film. But there's also another craft, which is to have very front of house visual effects, and that those effects aren't gratuitous but actually further the kind of design aesthetic, and are that obvious. I mean, Glazer did the Sony TV ad, you know, where they blew up the paint all over the tower block and stuff.
Oh, was that him? Yeah. Right. The Sony ones, and the then I guess he did the rubber balls down the.
I don't think he did the rubber balls. He might have. I know he did the second one. But the thing is, my point about that, right, is that that's a really bold idea that somebody's taken all the way through. Now, maybe he only did it all the way through because it had so much success with the balls in San Francisco, but. You know, a really powerful ad that has really strong visuals can often get throttled back because of people playing it safe in places. But you obviously get flexibility in music videos. But if you can take that into commercials and then into features and do the really... I mean, I'm sure there must have been some ad executive that walked on set the day he was shooting. This is now back to the film. We were shooting the, you know, him putting it together flashback sequence and said, why are we shooting, you know, these characters over and over again? What's happening? Because it wouldn't have made a lot of sense. But if you can get a supportive environment that lets you do that stuff, and then you don't care that it looks like it's, a composited, deliberately put together in a collage sense piece, and have the balls to put that out there for a commercial audience, for a very commercial film, I think that's brilliant. I really do. It's a real skill to be able to pull that off.
Well, the thing that works about the flashback, not the flashback, but the putting it together scene, is that it's exactly what Gondry would do in camera if he was doing, let's say it was a music video idea or one of his films where someone wasn't up his ass about it and he had free...
If that was the scene he was doing
scene,
for a week.
It would look exactly the same. You know, less, no 3D, maybe a little less polished, but it was exactly his style, much like the cars telescoping out. It wasn't a bastardization or a knockdown of his idea at all. Like, you would say that's exactly how he wanted it to be.
Well, we don't tend to talk about stars here, but I did some research that led me to believe that Seth actually was on this project first, that was instrumental in getting Gondry on, and then kind of protected him from the studio. That's not first-hand knowledge, but that's from what I could gather from
the scenes. Yeah, he got the project, he and his friend, based on Superbad, I believe, yeah. For writing.
Wow.
I don't even know if he was initially meant to star in it. That's speculation on my part, but...
Wow. Testament to the power of Seth, that he has clout and studio power over Gondry, who's done many more features and been doing since Seth was in Short Pants, as they say.
Yeah. And it was such a good move, because if this had been a ho-hum kind of thing, it would have been, who hasn't seen on video? I know I saw something, God, if you were, how was it called? Beverly Hillbillies. It was like the worst translation from a repackaged thing in history. It was like, I could do anything to get that 90 minutes back in my life. But, this didn't feel like a rehack. I don't know that we needed it to be the Green Hornet to be a good film. If this had just been, the Green Hornet thing seemed to translate to the masks and that was about it. From my point of view, you could have almost made this film and not had the link to the Green Hornet. I know they did that to... get opening weekend box office, but there was little in this film that required it to have come from the, historical place that it did, as opposed to something like a Spider-Man or a Batman, which steeped in kind of mythology.
It probably just made it easier to write, just because you had a basic framework of plot and arc that you could wrap your comedy around as a writer.
Yeah. Though I'm sure they struggle with how not to have the most condescending attitude with Kato going.
Yeah.
Okay, so I've got one other thing. Now, I'm going to have to ask Jason at this point to not be offended when I say this is probably something that, Jace, you and I are going to appreciate more. But there was a moment in this film where one of the lead actresses was having jokes made at her expense about her age. And I swear to God, it took me forever to get that Cameron Diaz was meant to be old, because of course Cameron Diaz in my head isn't old, because of course I'm not old in my head. Jace, did you have that moment as well? Did that joke immediately telegraph to you?
Are you saying I'm old too? Or
you are actually about the same age that I am, so yes.
I'm pretty much exactly the same age as you, all right, fair enough.
I'm not that much younger. I'm not that much younger than you, unfortunately, for me.
Really? Because this woman was born in 72. When did someone born in 72 be old?
I was born in 71. Seriously. I'm older than her.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's my point, right? I was actually born a whole decade earlier than you,
yes.
So leave that alone. But, oh my God, I was like, huh? What's the joke? Huh? And then it just like dawned on me that the girl from Something About Mary was now considered old, and that was a joke. And
well, can I just say that actually the only weak point for me in the movie is Cameron Diaz. I don't really like her very much after the last 5 years, because she just turned into herself. I would much rather it have been. It was a really great opportunity to blow up a sort of up and comer, because it's not a focal role. You don't need it for the box office, and I hate to say it, but I think you could have gotten someone more attractive for it to be the girl that everyone, that the both of them are fighting over, like a Minka Kelly or somebody room. Like that. That's just me.
Tough room.
Yeah, well,
but they may have needed it for box office. You know, they may have needed it.
It's possible.
If they'd got Thingo from the girl that was with Seth in Knocked Up. What's her name?
Catherine Heigl.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Sure.
But having said that, I don't hold with the central premise that a 38-year-old is not attractive and
it wasn't because she was old. I just don't particularly find her attractive.
It's just that a guy born the year I left school, being Seth, considers somebody in their 30s old. You bastard. Anyway, enough of that.
I thought that was a funny joke, actually. When he
really?
Yeah, the Twilight. When he was like, in your later years, why would you want, like, I don't know.
Let me come back and check with you on that.
I just thought they played him as a moron.
I'll see if you find that joke.
Well, they played him really well then because he was borderline sort of hating him. You know, just because of his character, not just because Seth himself, but just I was sort of close to just like just got away with it, I think. But I mean, that's going really back to sort of bare basics of the whole film. I think it was. It is very much driven by him. So, they had to really play it quite close as to how far they pushed him being a bit of a dick. I think they came close to me. I think I just sort of found him almost borderline offensive, and the funny kind of slipped away a little bit, but that's me. I think if you're a real, really, real big fan of Seth, you'll completely overcome all that sort of stuff. That was probably the one niggling thing to me, So
this other thing about this film that I think would interest the three of us and hopefully all the listeners is that while this was shot on film and dimensionalized as we discussed, in fact, there was pickup shots done according to IMDb Pro on the Red One, well, on an MX Red One, and they were actual 3D pickups because between when they shot it, obviously, and when they went back for pickups, they had decided to... Does anyone know anything about that?
A friend of a friend who I spoke to on the phone today had worked on the film in a capacity I cannot mention, but the information is correct. And the reason I was interested to find out, one of the reasons, wasn't the main reason, but it was an interesting sort of game for me, was I had read on Red User a while back that John Schwartzman had posted about the DP, had posted about doing pickups, and it was his first quote-unquote gig using an MX, which is, I think, or using a Red, which I think is really, it's great, was pickups for the Green Hornet, and that he decided after doing all his camera tests that he felt MX Red had the closest match to film, especially for anamorphic. So
now, I think John then went on to. Oh, is he shooting?
Now he's shooting
Transformers. I think.
No, now he's shooting Spider-Man Epic Stereo.
Oh, yeah, Spider-Man
Stereo. That's Epics. Right.
What we don't know about the 3D stuff or the pickups was: were they doing 3D pickups because to reshoot stuff that they couldn't be dimensionalized?
No, well I'll tell. So I think it was pickups. It was just extra scenes, right, or things that they weren't able to get in principal photography. And in post that Schwartzman had made, he said that because the visual effects houses were so slammed with the dimensionalization and the shots that he didn't want to shoot 2D plates to add to their workload. So he decided to actually shoot in stereo to deliver, because I think most of them aren't really effects. There's not a lot of effects shots in the pickup shots, so they just shot it stereo, had stereo footage, and...
The decision to go 3D. Yeah, because the decision to go 3D was not one made until it was not a decision, conscious decision to do post dimensionalizing until way after the whole principal photography had been wrapped. Right, much later after that.
Well, so hang on, but Jace, did you notice any shots that stood out that looked different? Because it sounds Jason knows, but did you see anything?
Not really. There's a couple little things which I really started looking for it around the reflections of the car in the garage. Some really tough stuff. I mean, I think apart from some of the effects shots, I think one of the most impressive VFX, points of the film is how well it looks dimensionalized. I've got to say, I know there's a lot of on-set 3D stereographers who aren't exactly on the unemployment line, but I think this is definitely an interesting step to see that post-dimensionalizing can work. To me, I wasn't sort of being taken out of the film. It's a couple little moments with reflection around cars, as they say, but all in all, I think it's, they pulled it off.
Are you allowed to tell us, Jason, any particular shot that was...
Yeah, I can tell you all of them.
Okay.
I actually...
Were there many?
There's three sort of sections. One of them, I actually, after the film, I was talking to my friend who I went with, and I said, I think that scene, I only was able to pick out one, And when I talked to my friend's friend today, I asked him, and he's like, yep, that's one of them. And I was fairly pleased, a little pat on my back, you know, to have
what
picked it out.
What was it about it that made it obvious to you? Are you talking about image quality, or are you talking about stereo effect?
It wasn't a stereo issue. I think it was just I know what red footage looks like, and
yeah.
And I think it was a slight skin tone difference and some difference in the blacks. So I'll start at the top. The first MX scene is the James Franco scene in the beginning. The entire, not the walk up, not the explosions.
Really?
Just from when he...
Oh, the you don't think I'm scary with the dual gun?
In that room. Yeah, everything in that room is MX.
I love that scene.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think the reason that I wasn't able to pick that one out was because I had no reference. It was so early in the film that you just had no visual reference for comparison.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of – there's definitely a different shooting style that comes – I'm sorry to interrupt, Jace, but that style, that sort of scene maybe is shot a little bit wider than the rest. If you look at some of the opening scenes with the little boy in Dad's office and the doll being thrown in the bin and all that stuff, that is very in-your-face, quite close, quite oppressive. I know that's the nature of the scene, but it's possibly – shot, you may not have done some of those shots if you were wielding a 3D camera at the time. You might not have
absolutely
been
right.
So you're saying now that it wasn't a difference due to cameras or the fact that it was stereo, but actually you staged the shot differently because you now were aware that it was stereo.
Yeah.
Well, and
and depth is a little bit more something that you don't have, you know, you want to sort of back off a little bit, I think, you know.
Well, I'm loving this inside gossip.
Well,
so tell us.
Also, well, so the other thing, in that Franco scene is if you, the camera doesn't move, it looks like a sticks, you know, just shot reverse shot kind of thing, which is, seems like what you would do at least, blowing through a scene like that with more of just an acting dialogue scene, with a, like a giant stereo rig. I mean, you're not going to hoist that thing up and carry it around. Mm. So the other one in order is when they go to Chudnovsky's, Christoph Waltz's office in the cement factory, not the scene where he shoots Edward Furlong.
Which, by the way, was, wow, that's Edward Furlong. But
yeah, well, especially because he's a real heroin addict. So.
Is he?
Yeah, that's what I said. He's pretty much playing himself. Well, that's a bit unfair.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm not saying that jokingly. I just, you know, it just, it's...
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
One of those things. Yeah. But yeah, he was great.
Is he now okay that he's acting again? Or is he?
I think he's better.
Well, not that I care, but anyway, whatever. I liked him so much in Terminator 2 that I can't help but be happy to see him on screen.
So after that scene, I think there's three more scenes in his office. The three scenes in his office or so after the Edward Furlong scene are all MX pickups on a soundstage.
Okay.
Which I thought, I mean, they matched perfectly.
Yeah.
And then the scene, this is the scene that I picked out, was when he's on the, when Chudnovsky's on the roof and he says he's going to change his name to Bloodnovsky.
Yep.
And shoots the guy with the one eye.
Mm.
That whole scene on the roof is MX also.
Seemed like a bit of an odd scene, that one. Like, I kept wondering, what's he looking at? Why are we on the rooftop? It seemed a little bit... It was probably one little scene that stood out. I kept thinking,
just
what's
a location. Yeah, they were probably like, what location can we use? Just put him on the roof of the club.
Yeah, on the roof of the studio or something.
Generally speaking, giving that character some more quirkiness was a good move, because otherwise he'd have been a bit of a forgettable villain.
Yeah, I thought he was great. I thought he was... His comic timing is great.
The crap out of me. He's awesome.
That first one, when he was sitting in the chair in the nightclub, was a great addition to the film and really set the tone well.
Yeah.
And nice to give some really good humor to someone other than the lead actors.
Yeah.
I mean, the you know what I mean?
You just want to just shout at him saying, dude, do not piss this guy off. Have you not seen Inglourious Basterds? Come on.
Talk about a sense of foreboding. The more that guy spoke, and by the way, the guy that was King later intimidated, the one that was initially had the four guys behind him, that actor was good too, because he was very funny with his putting down and go and have your Metamucil and retire.
That was James Franco.
But again, all that dialogue, it was beautifully written. It had great dialogue, and it was
James Franco, wasn't it?
Very, very un-Hollywood dialogue, and it very much, even the baddies, everyone's dialogue sort of broke the mold. It was terrific. They had some great stuff to work with.
And they did use some iconics cameras to codex boxes for some tight space shots as well.
Okay.
Which I hadn't seen listed anywhere else.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny. Someone like James Franco, I always find like good actors doing good character pieces. I tend to remember them as the character, and I have a lot of trouble remembering where I've seen them before. And there are other actors, like, I don't know, well, maybe they're better well-known, but there are other actors that seem to play themselves in every movie, if that makes sense. And you...
Yeah.
No one's agreeing with me on this? Okay.
No.
But you know what I mean? Like,
I don't think...
I didn't... Yeah.
I think James Franco makes good, pretty good choices. I like him as an actor.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so were there any other MX sequences? Because,
no,
I mean, that intercutting is a really interesting thing. I mean, the worst intercutting I've ever seen was when they tested the original Sony HD cameras on Star Wars when he was outside. Yeah, and it was like, whoa, what was that scene? And why did you even have it?
Yeah.
What's this thing about the blood? But everything about that just screamed, that didn't intercut very well. Whereas this, I thought intercut just seamlessly, actually, really well.
Yeah,
I mean, I only because I read that post that Schwartzman had made, did I even know to sort of be aware of it. Otherwise, I never would have picked it up. But here, I pulled up Schwartzman's IMDb. He's made a couple movies you might have seen called...
Couple little indie
The
things.
Rock. Yeah, The Rock, Conspiracy Theory, a little summer indie movie called Armageddon, EdTV, Pearl Harbor, The Rookie.
He did Pearl Harbor. Yeah, I thought he did.
Yeah. The Rookie, Seabiscuit, Meet the Fockers, National Treasure, Book of Secrets, The Bucket List, The Second Night at the Museum movie. I mean, the guy clearly knows visual effects and giant movies.
Okay, well, just in finishing up, I want to do something for my own benefit, which is terribly selfish, but you'll understand why. I really hate it when people nitpick films over continuity problems, because, you know, there's a point at which I really don't get taken out of a film, and that is normally I don't get taken out of a film if somebody's newspaper was left to the right or the left. And so I'm going to call out IMDb Pro for a goof of their goofs, because they've said that there's a continuity error in this film, that when it comes to the hotel, that the sign of the hotel is upside down outside the hotel. And in fact, the name of the hotel when they go inside at the very beginning when he throws the TV out the window is upside down. Hello, that is how the actual darn thing is in real life if you've ever been to the hotel. So, you know, goof on the goof page.
Yes, it is. It is really upside down for real.
Yeah, so it's kind of...
That was great, that scene. I love that scene.
The standard.
It was fantastic. Him chinking the glass, the bottle of beer inside the plasma TV. And
I've never thrown a TV out the window, but I've certainly been to the bar. And let's not deny it. You know, Seth had lost a bit of weight for that role. He was looking like he'd trimmed down. And that night, that first scene on because I was a little worried, you know, because he's obviously played things like he did in Knocked Up, where he was kind of a slob, and I couldn't imagine him punching anyone convincingly on screen when I saw the casting ages ago. So anyway, but that being said, I think we should agree that we all love Michel Gondry, and that anyone that's listening to this hasn't seen Michel Gondry's earlier work, as we said earlier, should go check it out. Buy the DVDs if you can, or borrow them from someone if you can. I want to thank you guys for being on the show. I've really enjoyed having this chat. I know we've discussed directors a bit, but it really is in the context of people being able to deploy visual effects in an interesting and unusual way. Jason, where can people find you if they want to follow up on you and what you're up to?
On the Twitters, Jason Diamond, one word, and at my company's website, MBS Productions, which is like Monkeys Buy Shoes.
And Mr. Wingrove.
I'm on Twitter as twitter.com/Wingrove, or my website, jasonwingrove.com, and also on the podcast that you and I do together, Mike, the RC, at fxguide.com/podcast.
And, of course, I'm over at FX Guide and FX PhD, where we have some really interesting courses on stereo this term, if you're into that kind of stuff. And if you want to have a look at those stories that Ian Fales wrote for us over, please. Then I want to thank our producers, Todd and Matt, who do a great job with putting the show together. Also want to explain, when we moved to the new site, there were some issues which were just standard technical stuff that made it really hard for our team that was working incredibly hard to get the feeds all running into iTunes successfully. So that was not people not paying attention. We did absolutely tons of work to make that as seamless as possible. But I know that some of the people that are listening to this show, you would might have had a problem with last week's feed. It took a little bit of time to get to you, and I thank you for your patience. That should all be now pretty much resolved, and from here on out, we should be good. There used to be a site called The VFX Show. That's now redirecting to our main site, which is the podcasting page of FX Guide. And if you click on the sliding bars at the top there to The VFX Show, which is on the hard right, it'll automatically filter everything below it to all of our shows, leading back to, we've done a lot of them now. This is about 116th show. So, look, guys, thank you so much for being on here. Clearly, thunder does strike lightning. Thank you so much for being with us, and we'll see you next week. See you.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011 FX Guide, LLC.